and let's generate our motivation. When you're working with power tools, you don't fall asleep, because you realize that if you do, there's some danger of getting hurt. Similarly, in samsara, we don't fall asleep. We try not to fall asleep in the sleep of ignorance, because we know that when our mind gets overwhelmed by ignorance, then there's much danger to our well-being. And so we make every effort we can to stay awake with the light of wisdom and not let the mind space out or live on automatic or succumb to the peer pressure of ignorant views of other people. And in doing that, we make it possible for ourselves to create the causes of happiness and abandon the causes of suffering. Not just the happiness and suffering while we're in samsara, but the causes of the ultimate happiness of liberation and abandoning the real suffering, the dukkha of samsara. And then realizing that this alone, while good, is not sufficient, because there's everybody else who is just like us and wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, and who have been kind to us. And so just as we would help ourselves because we see value in ourselves, then we help others because we see value in them. And so in this way, we aspire for the full enlightenment of Buddhahood in order to be able to be of most effective benefit to ourselves and to all others as well. So generate that motivation. So when our mind is agitated with anger, you know, there's some feeling inside. We know something's wrong. Yeah, the mind's quite unhappy. When the mind is agitated with attachment, we often feel very happy. So it's harder to identify that as a mental state to be abandoned. But if we start looking closer, we can see that the mind is agitated when it's attached. It's not a peaceful, calm mind, and that the attachment can bring also some worry and fear about losing what we have or being disappointed by it. But ignorance is a hard one to recognize, because when the mind is ignorant, we're not necessarily agitated. There's two main kinds of ignorance. One is the ignorance of the ultimate nature, that's the grasping at true existence. And the other is ignorance involving the conventional nature, in particular the functioning of karma and its effects. When we have the ignorance of true existence arise, the self-grasping ignorance, we can still create virtuous actions. That ignorance itself is not non-virtuous, because you can still have self-grasping and create virtue. Like, I'm going to make offerings to the Buddha. Okay, You know, there's some grasping at your existence there. Or, I'm keeping precepts. Yeah. So, there can, you know, the self-grasping itself isn't non-virtuous. So it's possible to still create virtue. But that virtue ripens within samsara. Because anything that is motivated, that has that first link of self-grasping ignorance, the most it can bring is happiness within samsara. So it does get us to approach, you know, higher states of consciousness, but it itself is not a direct cause for liberation. It can be maybe an indirect cause, in that it brings us a precious human life or brings us the conditions that we need to be able to practice the Dharma. The other kind of ignorance, and so this first kind of ignorance of the ultimate state, when it's in the mind, so often we're not even aware of it. You know, I mean, we can't even understand that it's there, you know, grasping at true existence, what in the world's that? Yeah? So it's often hard to recognize. The other kind of ignorance is the misunderstanding of the functioning of cause and effect. And that ignorance is also very dangerous. It's not the root of samsara, in that, you know, when the ignorance of cause and effect is manifest in the mind, we can only create non-virtue. Yeah, there's no way to create any virtuous, you know, mental states motivated by that. But this ignorance of cause and effect is also one that we often don't even recognize when it's in our mind, because it's the mind that justifies and rationalizes and denies and doesn't even see our negative actions. We could be acting negatively, we don't even realize it's negative, okay? Or in the back of our mind there might be some thought it's negative, but we don't really want to give it up. And we have all sorts of reasons why this negative action is actually okay, you know? And so out of this kind of ignorance of karma and its effects, we can generate a whole ton of wrong views. You know, like wrong views about the path, wrong views about causes of happiness and suffering, wrong views about Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, you know, because we're just totally zoned out when it comes to what creates happiness and what creates suffering. And so again, that mental factor can be very active in our mind. But we don't necessarily feel out of sorts or agitated or grumpy because of it. So we don't even necessarily recognize it as a defilement or as something to be abandoned. Yeah, because when we're uncomfortable emotionally, when we're unhappy, then we want to practice the Dharma to get rid of that uncomfortable mental state. But when we're happy, or when we're neutral, you know, why practice the Dharma? Yeah, it's not going to bring me anything right now. So we zone out. So with attachment, you know, attachment feels kind of good. Well, I don't need Dharma practice now. Yeah, I only need it when I don't get what I want. But now that I have what I want, it's fine. Yeah. Or, this whole thing of holding on to various wrong views that we have. Well, I feel fine, you know. What I'm doing isn't negative. It's fine. Nothing wrong with it. Yeah, it was just a little white lie. It's, you know, no big thing. I just did a small negativity. And anyway, you know, the psychologists say that acting like this is fine, so it must be okay. And, my doctor told me it was okay to do this, so it must be okay. Or, you know, my parents or even the preacher, you know, the preacher said it's okay to kill insects or, you know, kill animals to eat them or make offerings of them or whatever, so it must be okay. And, you know, and so there's no effort to understand what causes happiness and what causes suffering. Okay, and so we just kind of go on creating negative karma out of our ignorance. Yeah. Or we think, you know, that this kind of ignorance is also the one that thinks that, okay, if I just do this ritual perfectly, then I'll, you know, I'll get what I want. So not thinking that we have to transform our mind, we just have to pronounce the mantra correctly and do the ritual correctly. Yeah, and not do it incorrectly because, oh, that's very bad. But, you know, your mental state doesn't matter while you're doing it. Okay, so that kind of wrong view, that comes from this ignorance of cause and effect as well. Okay, so grasping onto wrong modes of conduct, thinking that they're the path, grasping onto rituals and rites as the path when they aren't. All these kinds of things come out of this ignorance of conventional truth, specifically karma and its effects. So this is one reason why it's very important to study the chapter on karma in the Lamrim and to learn about karma in many, many different ways. You know, for example, when we study refuge, there's a lot of information there about how we create virtue and non-virtue in relationship to the three jewels. You know, things that we've never even thought to think about before. You know, like we get a Buddha statue and, okay, you know, we'll put it in the bathroom or use it as a paperweight or, you know, I can put my newspapers on top of it or, you know, I'll draw a mustache on the Buddha because I think it looks kind of cute and, you know, these kinds of things. And in the meantime, not realizing that we're creating negative karma. Or you look at some of the soldiers in China or in Burma destroying holy objects, thinking that what they're doing is something good. You know, they haven't heard teachings on refuge and how to create we create virtue and non-virtue in relationship to the three jewels. Okay, so we want to learn about that. Now, if we learn about the bodhisattva vows, then that helps us. Tantric vows, that helps us. So even if we haven't taken those vows, still it helps us to you know, get an idea of the kinds of things where the Buddha is guiding us on what to practice and what to abandon. Okay? So that can be very helpful in reducing our ignorance. Okay, similarly, studying the chapter in the Lamrim about the second noble truth, the cause of dukkha, where we talk about the afflictions, you know, what are our mental afflictions, and learning those and then being able to recognize them in our mind when they come up. Because so often we can say, you know, well, arrogance is this, and you know, self-grasping ignorance is that, and jealousy is this one. But when they come in our mind, boy, we don't recognize them. You know, arrogance comes in the mind, and we feel kind of proud of ourselves, you know? I feel good today. I have high self-esteem. Actually, it's arrogance, you know? Similarly, you know, we put ourselves down, we beat ourselves up, and not realizing that that's an inverted kind of arrogance. It's a different kind of conceit. And instead we think, oh, well, I'm being very humble today. You know, well, it's not. It's just beating ourselves up in inverted conceit. So, you know, coming to actually understand and recognize in our own mind what's virtue and what's non-virtue, it takes some time, you know, and a lot of introspection, really, looking and examining what's going on inside. Okay, but it's something worthwhile to do. So even if it's hard, even if it takes time, even if it's sometimes uncomfortable, it's still worthwhile to do. Okay, so just because something doesn't make us happy doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. Yeah, Jompel's slogan is, if I don't want to do it, it means it's good for me. He says that a lot, doesn't he? Yeah, Because usually when our mind is out of sorts, the last thing we want to do is the thing we really need to do. You know, because it's the opposite of what we are doing. You know, like when we're jealous, the last thing we want to do is rejoice at somebody else's good fortune. But that's the exact antidote to jealousy, is rejoicing at their talents and their fortune. Okay? So, you know, just because we don't feel like doing something doesn't mean we shouldn't do it, doesn't mean it's not good for us. Because if we use that as a criteria, I mean, that's what worldly people use as a criteria of what to do and what not to do. If I don't feel like doing it, then it's bad for me. Yeah. Yeah, well, that's one reason that my mom wound up in such poor health, because she didn't exercise, because she didn't like it. She didn't feel it like it. So that affected her health very dramatically. So just because we don't feel like doing something doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. Doesn't mean it's bad for us. Okay, that's not the proper criteria for evaluating virtue and non-virtue. If I feel like it. So, you know, we have to be careful here. Okay, let's go on to the second verse. Whenever I am with others, I will practice seeing myself as the lowest of all, and from the very depth of my heart, I will respectfully hold others as supreme. Okay. I'm glad George Bush doesn't know that we're saying this, because he would probably arrest me. This is a totally un-American idea. Okay. Seeing ourselves, you know, what right American would see themselves as the lowest of all? You know, really, that's not what we do. We're the best. And we have to make everybody realize that. So we do it on a national level. We do it on a group level. We do it on a personal level. And it's not just limited to Americans either. Okay. But, you know, this whole thing, there's another saying that whenever I am with others, I should watch what I say, and whenever I am alone, I should watch what I think. Yeah, because when we're with others, that doesn't mean you don't watch what you think when you're with others, because to watch what you're saying, you have to also watch what you think. But you have to really watch what you say, because others are right there, and it's very easy to commit verbal non-virtue, you know, with others. Okay. But then when we're alone and there aren't other people to swear at and criticize, it doesn't mean that we let our guard down and don't look at our mind. We still have to be vigilant and pay attention and observe what is going on in our mind, what the thoughts are. Okay. Okay. But here it's saying, whenever I am with others, I will practice seeing myself as the lowest of all. Now, what in the world does that mean? Okay. Now, our normal mind says, see ourselves as the lowest of all. That means having low self-esteem. That means doubting myself. That means putting myself down. That means hiding my good qualities and not sharing my knowledge. Okay? In other words, it means just sitting there like the kid that was told to shut up. Okay? That's the kind of the idea that we have, isn't it? Yeah? That's wrong. Wrong again, folks. Okay? We're wrong again. Okay, holding ourselves as the lowest of all. It means, first of all, really respecting other people. Seeing some good quality in everybody. Okay? And respecting that good quality that they have. And I think we can find some good quality in everybody, even in this life. And having some respect for that. I used to watch Lama Yeshe, you know, how he behaved with people, because you can learn a lot from watching other people, you know. And so I used to watch, and sometimes in the meditation courses, people would ask the most outrageous questions, you know, and go on and on asking a question, and say all sorts of weird things, you know, like, Lama, isn't there some kind of cosmic mind that, you know, we're all a part of that cosmic mind, and so therefore we don't have our own separate egos, and we just have to tune into that cosmic mind and become oneness. And Lama would say, oh yes, dear, you're right. There, you know, there is something beyond your ego. And then he would go on and talk about, you know, wisdom and compassion as being something beyond your ego. Okay. So he found that one phrase in all that cockamamie stuff that person was saying, you know, and he pulled that out and said, oh, yes, dear, you're right. And then, you know, took it and explained how the person should actually think in the right way. Yeah. So he didn't go, you know, that's the most outrageous, stupid, ridiculous view I've ever heard. One cosmic mind. Are you out of your mind? You know? Kind of, where is this cosmic mind anyway? And, you know, why did we split off for it? It doesn't make any sense. You know, Lama didn't do that. He didn't humiliate somebody. Okay? He just was very skillful in that way. So that to me is a manifestation of seeing yourself as the lowest of all. There was the opportunity where he could have humiliated somebody, but he didn't. Yeah. Or there was the opportunity where he could have gone, well, I have the correct view, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Yeah. Now, Lama may have chose to debate that person. That doesn't mean he would be humiliating him if he had seen that that was the right way to, you know, deal with that person's wrong view. He could have done that. That's not seeing yourself as the best of all if you have the correct motivation. Okay? But just the thing of finding something to respect, some way to affirm people. Okay? Because we are so used to, is the word disaffirming them? Undermining them. So our judgmental, critical mind, you know, that finds fault in everybody, and that whatever they're doing, it isn't good enough, or it isn't enough, and so always judging, finding fault, criticizing, yeah, that kind of mind is coming from a certain kind of arrogance within us. Mm-hmm. So even if we don't give voice to all our judgments and criticisms, still that mechanism is going on. Because the way the mind thinks is, if everybody else is so bad, then I must be the only good one. Yeah? And Geshe Nalandarga used to say, we get together with our friends and then we trash somebody else, and the conclusion is that we're the best ones. Yeah, and we do that, don't we? You know, in an office situation or a working situation, we gang up with other people and scapegoat one person, and then, you know, that person's the source of all the problems in the office, which means that the rest of us are all scot-free, innocent, sweet, and benevolent. Okay? So that's a kind of arrogance, isn't it? You know, holding ourselves as the lowest of all doesn't mean having low self-esteem. It just means respecting others and being able to see the goodness in them and point out their goodness to them. Yeah? Because so often we point out their faults, but it's just as important to point out their goodness. And, you know, this is something that's very important in being a parent, in, you know, And so many of us are not parents, but it's not limited to being a parent, but it applies in other situations too. Whereby if you tell a child, you know, you're a bad kid, you're not really giving them much information except that you don't like them at that moment. Because they don't necessarily understand what behavior they did that you're upset about. Okay? Because kids, you know, you can do an awful lot of things in 10 minutes. And somebody tells you you're bad and you're not sure which one of the things you did is the reason you're being told you're bad. Or the same thing when they say you're good. You don't necessarily understand what the behavior was. So that kind of feedback, telling somebody you're a bad person, you're a good person, it doesn't give them much that's constructive. And also, it's confusing the action with the person. Because doing a good action doesn't mean the person's good. Doing a bad action doesn't mean the person's bad. Okay? What we need to do when we give feedback is, you know, when you do this, it affected me this way, and that's why I'm unhappy. And so that gives a child specific information. You know, when you left your shoes in the middle of the hall, I tripped over them, and I'm not happy about that. Yeah, and then it lets the child know that leaving your shoes in the middle of the hall isn't so good, but you're not telling them that they're a bad human being because of it. Okay? So similarly, you know, when we're at work, if you're giving feedback to somebody, if you just say, you know, you're the biggest jerk I've ever met, or if you're quarreling with your spouse or, you know, a family member, and, you know, you say that kind of thing, it doesn't give them any kind of useful information. So it's much better to let people know specific actions that they did that affected you adversely without commenting on who they are as a human being. Okay? And similarly, you know, if we do have to give that kind of feedback, to give it with a kind mind, not an angry mind. But also similarly, not just restrict our feedback to people's negative behavior, but to be able to point out their positive behavior. Yeah. So you do it when you're raising kids and say, you know, when you cleaned up your room, I really appreciated it because I can walk into a space that's clean and neat and feel good being there. And then the kid knows, oh, this behavior affects somebody in this way. Yeah. And so similarly with adults, you know, somebody does something, I really appreciate your getting this to me on time, and it's, you know, you completed all the points in it. So, you know, you let people know specifically what it is that you appreciate they're doing. Okay? So I think seeing ourselves as the lowest of all involves these other behaviors as well. It's not just, you know, it is not having low self-esteem. It's learning how to connect to people in a respectful way and give them feedback that is actually useful to them. And so I think it's also very important that we learn to praise other people to their face and behind their back, and to praise them not because we want them to like us, which is often our usual reason for saying nice things to somebody, but because we really genuinely see their good quality and we know that praising other people is good for us. Okay? So in the same way it came out yesterday that if we're generous, we feel good. Well, how about being generous in terms of pointing out others' good qualities? Isn't that a form of generosity? Mm-hmm. Shouldn't that make us feel just as good as giving them a present? Yeah, pointing out their good qualities, praising them either to their face or behind their back. Yeah? And if you practice it, you know, it's a very interesting thing. Try it for a week. You know, try praising other people to their face and behind their back and see how you feel at the end of it. And if in the middle of it, you know, it's hard to get the words out, then What you're doing is you're being miserly, in the same way when we were saying yesterday, you know, what happens when, you know, there's something you can give it, but you don't want to give it, and you have all your reasons for not giving it. Well, that's miserliness, isn't it? So being similarly miserly with our kind words towards others. Okay, and so to see how it affects our own mind when we can say nice things to people. Yeah? Because it does affect our mind a lot, doesn't it? And it's a very good antidote to this critical mind that's always, you know, pestering people. And, you know, when we do point out the things that people do well to them, it encourages them to keep doing more. Mm-hmm. I was just reading the Sutra of the Mindfulness of Breathing. And in this sutra, it's the end of the rainy season, and the senior monastics had been teaching the junior monastics, and the junior monastics had been practicing according to their instructions and getting very good results in their meditation, gaining realizations. And the Buddha praised the Sangha at that time. And it was really touching reading in this sutra the Buddha's praise for the Sangha, you know? And it made me think, oh, I want to be like that, you know? I mean, I want to be like somebody that the Buddha could praise instead of, you know, just find fault with, well, she's not doing this and she's doing that and shouldn't be and, you know, da-da-da-da-da. But you could see that encouragement, you know, really encourage not only the monastics 2,600 years ago, but even me, you know, all these years later to, you know, kind of try better, you know, try more. Okay? To see ourselves as the lowest of all. Seeing ourselves as the lowest of all also means that we learn to give people feedback and help that they need. Okay? So if, you know, very often, like we may go in a situation and we don't know the protocol or the etiquette in that situation, or we don't know exactly how to behave, isn't it helpful when somebody comes and tells us? You know? Or if we're doing something, you know, if we're not keeping our precepts well or acting in a way that's really not becoming, do you want somebody to point it out to you? Or do you want to continue acting that way? You probably say, I don't want either. But the point is, you're not going to stop acting that way unless somebody points it out to you. Yeah? I mean, if you're making a really big mistake and creating some non-virtue, do you want your friends to let you do it? No. So even if it stings, wouldn't you want your friend to say, you know, that's not appropriate action, or, you know, you're doing this and I'm really concerned about you doing this? Wouldn't you want somebody to make a comment? I would. You know, if I'm really behaving off the wall, I want somebody to call me on it. Because it's too dangerous for myself and for other people if I keep doing that. Yeah? Or if I'm in a situation and I'm not behaving appropriately, you know, like when I went to Thailand, I didn't know the etiquette there. And so I was doing, you know, I was doing things at the wrong time. You know, it's like it was really funny there. When their teacher comes in, they don't stand up. And to me, it was like, I stood up, and everybody's looking at me. You know, but to me, I mean, that's how I show respect. But then I had to realize, oh, no, you know, they do it differently. The teacher comes in, they're still seated. On the other hand, when they spoke to their teacher was sitting or standing, and they kneeled down when they spoke to him, which is something that we don't do. Okay, so, but it was a thing of, you know, learning, well, what's the behavior in that situation, yeah? So I think that seeing ourselves as the lowest of all also involves helping people in that way. and as well as making ourselves receptive to help. Okay? So many people who come to the Abbey, you know, don't know how we do things, and some of them will say, well, tell me what to do. Yeah, I want to know what to do because I don't want to offend anybody. I don't want to make things out of sorts. So tell me what to do. So, you know, and even if somebody doesn't say that, I think people do appreciate when Abbey residents and the monastics kind of give them some guidance on different etiquette points or this or that or the other thing. And so it's our responsibility to help other people in this way. But what I find is so often people don't say a word. And it puzzles me no end. Yeah? I mean, I was so glad when I was in Thailand that sometimes the monk said to me, you know, like I was really puzzled at the beginning why no monk would hand me something directly. They would say, here's a piece of, they would say, here, look at this, and then run over here and put it on a table. You know? So it was, you know, I learned, they don't hand things directly to women. Okay, because I couldn't figure it out. Yeah, actually I knew that one from before, so I was aware of it, but I had to remind myself. You know, so those kinds of things. Then, you know, I don't understand why people sometimes are so shy about helping each other in that way. Yeah? I mean, if I went to an interfaith conference and I was doing something really disrespectful inside a church or a mosque or a temple, I would want somebody to point it out to me. Yeah? Doesn't mean I'm bad, it just means I don't know their etiquette, you know, because etiquette isn't necessarily virtuous or non-virtuous, it's just habits that people do. But especially if I'm making a mistake and doing something non-virtuous, I would want somebody to point it out. Yeah? And I also feel that, you know, it's my responsibility to say things to people, unless I've had some prior dealing with that person, or I know something of that person, and I know it's only going to make them angry. You know? So, you know, it doesn't mean you have to go around with your family, you know, pointing out every little thing they do, because that's going to make them angry, you know? And it doesn't mean in the monastery you point out every little thing people do either. But when, you know, but when somebody's doing something that's clearly contra to like the Abbey guidelines, then we have a responsibility to say something. Otherwise, the whole structure that we're building here doesn't hold together. And I think new people who come here really appreciate people helping them out in this way. And so I'm always puzzled why people don't do that. Yeah? I'm really puzzled why people don't help each other in that way. Because I've seen it over and over and over again. And, you know, I don't know what it is if people are afraid that, you know, that if I say, please put your Dharma book on the table. Are they, you know, am I afraid? You know, oh, please put your Dharma book on the table. Oh, they're not going to like me anymore because I told them to put their Dharma book on the table. Am I that sensitive to what my reputation? Yeah. If I go to somebody and say, you know, you're not supposed to put your Dharma things on the floor, that's the wrong thing to do, then somebody's going to get irritated with me. Okay? But if I go and I instead of saying the wrong thing, you know, pointing out the wrong thing, just say, oh, here, you know, we put our Dharma things on tables in order to show respect to them, that's in no way critical of anybody else. It's helping them.
Do you want to answer?
Yeah.
I think a lot of the guests don't have a sense of ownership when they're here.
Mm-hmm.
So they feel it's not their place to do it, that the staff should do it, the staff should do it. You know,
mm-hmm.
They think of, rather than thinking that, you know, you always say in all of your literature, and you say it and the residents say, when you come to the Abbey, this is not a retreat center, there is no staff. There is no us and them. We're all being residents together for however long you're here. A lot of people don't that doesn't sink in, and so they think there is a staff, and it's the staff's job to tell people when they're not following protocol. I think that has more to do with it than almost anything.
Well, that would explain, you know, maybe for some of the guests, but what about the people who live here?
They're really busy. They don't always see it. And, you know, and you were talking about new people. That is, it's really, really helpful for me, you know, as many times as I've been here, to have someone, I do something bonehead for someone. Like last night, I was, you know, wiping the bowls, and I dripped some water, and I started to wipe it up on the floor, and Senpei goes, "Don't do that." And I'm going, you know, it's like, I just, you know, I had a momentary, you know, so it's not just new people need to be reminded. Everybody needs to be reminded to, you know, because like we're not, you know, always conscious.
And, you know, and that's an example of one that I was thinking about that too, Tanya, because I saw you do it, and I was like, and I didn't say anything. And I knew, but I didn't say anything. And I thought,
what was wrong with that, that you were using the altar cloth?
To wipe the floor that she was washing, cleaning, drying the water bowl. The water spilled, and she used the right, and then she was going to start to wipe the bowl.
To wipe the bowl again. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And then I saw her do it and didn't say, and I could have caught her. But I chose not to say anything, knowing that that was. So I thought about that when you said that we don't say things to people. And that both of us experienced that last night.
Yeah. And I was across the room and saw it.
Yeah. What?
Well, I could have caught her because I saw her going down.
But it isn't the thing of Tanya, don't do that. It's you did that. Now let's get a clean rag to do the rest of the bowls.
Which is what we did.
You know.
I stepped in and I was like.
Yeah, we all have senior moments. That's actually not a senior moment, but you know.
Well, I was also thinking, I mean, that's one thing, but I also think for people who come here a lot, there's certain small things, like, I mean, just small things, like, if we're starting to do something out of one of the books, and so we've been here before, and so we know what page it's on, just leaning over to the next person and showing them the page, or so kind of, I was thinking of little things like that, that may not so much involve etiquette, that maybe we don't quite know about, but little things like that.
Yeah, where we reach, showing somebody the right page in the prayer book. Yeah, or the people who need the prayers when we're doing it there, making sure they have them. There's just these things where we reach out to other people and help. So it doesn't mean, but, you know, also make sure you have the right information, because I've had people come to me and say, so-and-so corrected me for doing this. What was wrong about it? And I said, I don't know. I don't understand why that person corrected you. So also make sure that what you're correcting is, you know, is suitable. Okay? But, you know, I think we need to, and especially the residents here, you know, need to be more active in doing that.
Well, I know for me that it's a continual training, because I'm the one who just comes up and tells you how to do things, not like kindly, but tells you. My voice, I'm learning that it's the way that I say things that is not helpful. So I've gone through the past 3 months to a stage where I have totally pulled back from giving feedback, because I'm still not clear and very good about giving it in a way that's positive and people can hear it, rather than them getting defensive. So, like last night, I mean, I saw it and I did it because it was going to happen so fast, but the way that I said it to Tanya, because it was Tanya, I think she heard it, but somebody else would not have been able to hear it the way, the directness of which I said it to her. I could have handled that situation totally differently, but because it was right in the middle of happening, there was an immediacy to it, but it wasn't very skillful on my part. I could have certainly addressed it in a different way for Tanya. So then I back off and say, well, that was really very, very kind. So I've pulled back in the past few months, and I'd like to be able to do it because I see a lot of things, but I'm the nitpicker, you know, and that's what I'm also trying to retrain myself is which ones really matter.
And which ones don't.
And which ones don't.
Yes.
And the ones that matter, how do you say it so you're affirming that the person's trying and that they just need some guidance.
Yeah.
But my habit is not to be like that. My habit is to be in your face. Mm-hmm. And so I'm still in the retraining mode.
Yeah.
So that's what I
think. Yeah. And I think one way that I'm working on, too, in terms of retraining, instead of saying don't do, it's much better to say do, you know, and show them the way that you would like them to do it. Yeah.
One thing as someone kind of here sometimes and out in my place, America is the land of the rugged individualist, as I often heard it said. The rugged individualist. And for the most part, my experience is people don't really appreciate being told what to do in any form whatsoever. And even from young age on up to, you know, any point of adulthood, we find out very quickly that often our best intentioned suggestions to others, even our friends, sometimes don't fall on the most friendly ears. And then we sort of pull back. And what you said about being so sensitive to our reputation that they won't like us. Actually, yeah, I really am that sensitive sometimes. I don't want to say anything that's going to get someone upset because I'm protected. I don't want to get anything negative feedback there. So it's a very interesting point of this fear that we carry around. Wanting to protect ourselves from other people's anger. Even if saying something is really for their benefit, don't do that, that's bad for you. Or we do this, however we phrase it, like we have our own benefit.
I mean, it is true that if we are nitpicking and if we have a certain tone of voice, we're asking for people to be upset. Okay? But, you know, I think learning, especially in a community, we have to learn to receive admonition and to give admonition.
Culture here is very different than outside.
Yeah.
That's something that I do learn a lot. I've been in my job. I get emails. I don't know. I hope that you have noticed that over the time I've been doing the website, my emails and discussion have become less, you know, pointed and, and sometimes even sounding hostile and fighting me into. And I'm trying to have it be more, you know, to sound, be able to sound, you know, more kindly. And it's my job, it really helps because I get emails all the time and say, you know, who wrote this stupid application and why doesn't it work, and I have to write back and say thank you very much for your feedback. What can I assist you, you know, to accomplish your goal in this application, you know? And it's really good training, you know. My reaction, you know, of course my reaction is going to be, you think my baby's ugly?
I just wanted to add one thing that I heard about. It was a couple of years ago, and I really try to keep this in mind. I just shared with so many people, so I wanted to share it. And this was about if you want to make a comment to anyone, there are these 4 points to think about. Is it kind? Is it true? Is it timely? Is it necessary? Mm-hmm. And I just thought that those, like, for me, were just really good things to kind of, you know, do I really need to jump in here right now and say something? You know, do I just want to say it, or does it really need to be heard? So for me, it was just really useful to have this work. That's what I just wanted to do.
Yeah.
And it's the fourth one that's hard.
Yeah.
Is it necessary?
Yeah.
Because that's when you have to stop and think, does this feedback or this suggestion or what I'm saying, is it because this is the way I want to see it done, or is it because it's something that really contributes to what that person has done.
Right.
And so that's the hard one.
But I think kindness, though, brings in the question of if someone is about to do something that's really going to create a really terrible situation, even though, as people kind of spoke about, even though they're going to get angry at you maybe, but isn't it kinder to say something than to just let it go?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, one of the auxiliary bodhisattva vows is to say something to somebody who's about to create non-virtue, if you see that, you know, you're saying something can have a difference. Yeah. When I used to, when I lived near Green Lake and I would see fishermen, I would like want to say something, but I knew it wouldn't make any difference. It would just create bad feelings, so I didn't say anything. I did prayers for the fish instead. But if it were, you know, some situation where it could make a difference, yeah, then actually, one of the bodhisattva precepts to benefit others is to do that. Interestingly, in the Bhikshuni precepts, one of our root downfalls, and we lose our ordination over this one, is if somebody else has created a root downfall, we don't bring it up to the community. Yeah? And the reason that that's a root downfall for the person, you know, who doesn't bring it up is because the other person doesn't have the chance to purify. Yeah? They broke a major vow that created negative karma. They need, you know, somebody to say something so they have the opportunity to purify. But nobody's saying anything. Yeah? So it's interesting that way. Yeah?
Looking at this issue, I also see I'm in a period where being quiet is better in the sense that before, often it would come from a very selfish place, ego building. And I haven't been here enough to know necessarily what is right and what is wrong, but in a broader sense, in situations where I do see something, I want to see something, I often don't because it will nourish the ego in a way that's not helpful to my practice.
Right. Right. And so in that way of restraining yourself, that's fine. You know, if you realize, okay, I'm not saying something because I'm not in a mental space where I can do this so that it becomes something beneficial for my own practice. Mm-hmm. Yeah? My motivation isn't clear or whatever it is, and so you restrain for that matter. That's good. You know, we have to learn to restrain that. Mm-hmm. But then other times where it could be something beneficial, and we know that it could make a difference and the other person is receptive, then to be able to say something. You know, because we care. You know? I think that's the real bottom line, is we care about that person. And we don't want to see them to create negative karma.
Yeah. Uh-huh. In position to point number two, saying something while holding yourself as the lowest, interesting place to say it from.
Yeah, exactly.
Like if your teacher is doing something, like if His Holiness were in here and you were doing something wrong, how would you explain to His Holiness, please?
Yeah. Yeah.
How would you do that?
Yeah. But you know, even in the Vinaya, you know, if your teacher is breaking one of the precepts, you're supposed to point it out. Mm. You're also supposed to defend your teacher, you know? Not defend them in an ego way, but not lose faith in them. But you should point it out. Yeah. And so something, I mean, I don't think His Holiness would be doing something non-virtuous, but, you know, there could be just different things. Somebody doesn't know what to do in a situation. Lots of times I go places and I don't know what I'm supposed to do. Like I walk in a room and to teach and nobody's guiding me to the front of the room and I look around and I'm not sure where the front is. Yeah? So those kinds of things, you know, it's very helpful if somebody steps forward and helps you out. Or I'm going to meet somebody, you know, and I enter the room and nobody introduces me. Who's the person who... I don't know any of the people here. I don't know who the host of the gathering is. Nobody introduces me. You know, oh, this is Mr. or Mrs. So-and-so's house. Oh, here's the person. Oh, thank you very much. You know, So just ways of, I think if we really have a motivation to benefit, and this is where seeing ourselves as the lowest of all comes in. Yeah, it's because we have this thing of, you know, I want to benefit, not that I want to correct you. Yeah. Okay? And so similarly, when people say things to us too, then to realize that they're trying to benefit and, not get so defensive. Even sometimes, although the way they say it is very offensive. Yeah. To try and, pick out what's worthwhile in that and just leave aside the rest, Okay. I'll practice seeing myself as the lowest of all. And from the very depth of my heart, I will respectfully hold others as supreme. So this doesn't mean pretending to hold others as supreme while you're really working for your own ego benefit. You know, because you see some people who, kind of are very gracious, very loving, very kind, very respectful, And is the mind really that way? Or is it, because they're trying to put on a good image for somebody. Okay? So we have to really look at our own mind, because it says from the very depth of my heart. In other words, very sincerely, I hold other sentient beings as worthwhile and valuable, and that's why I'm saying this. Not because I want to look like I'm being a humble disciple and I want to look like I'm, being very sweet and kind and blah, 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 but because I really care. Okay? Now, it is true that sometimes we have to practice doing the action even though we don't have the right motivation for doing it. But hopefully, sometimes in the process of doing it, then we're able to generate the correct motivation and transform the action.
Yeah. So the use of the word supreme here isn't necessarily that I think everyone's better than me. It's more that I have respect for.
I think everybody's worthwhile.
Yeah, respect and worthwhile.
Yeah. So it doesn't mean that we're constantly evaluating everybody in terms of social status.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, how can I see this homeless person as supreme? I have a house. No, that's not it. Okay? It's seeing that person as somebody worthwhile and respecting them as a human being. And here I think it was Eric from Boise who told me this story. Can't remember exactly. But he said that one time he was in Berkeley and there was one woman, homeless person on the street. And he just had a little bit of cash and, kind of had a dollar and he gave it to her with both hands and looked at her in the eye and said, I wish I could give you more, but this is what I have. And she started crying. And she said, nobody's ever talked to me like that. Yeah. So just, seeing her as worthwhile and, seeing himself as, she's giving me the opportunity to create the good karma of generosity. And so humbly giving in that way. Not, look how good I am, I'm giving to this person who's sitting on the street. Okay. Couple of minutes left. Actually, we're going to have to stop. But the third one says, in all actions I will examine my mind, and the moment a disturbing attitude arises, endangering myself and others, I will firmly confront and avert it. Okay, so in all actions, whatever we're doing, so like I said, not just when we're with other people, but also watch our mental actions when we're alone, and watch what we do when nobody else is around and not looking. Yeah? Yeah? And you know, how we were talking about this yesterday, how we'll say to somebody else, don't do that, but when other people aren't looking, we'll do it. Okay? So to watch all of our actions. Okay. In all actions, I will examine my mind, and the moment a disturbing attitude arises. So the moment an afflicted state of mind is manifest, not 10 years later, but the moment it does, yeah, I will recognize it as something that endangers me and other people. It endangers me because I create negative karma that will cause me misery. It endangers others because I'm being the condition for their misery. Okay? And so seeing the disadvantages of that, I will firmly confront and avert it. Okay? Firmly confront, you know, seeing it as something dangerous, you know, that involves counteracting that ignorance that I was talking about at the beginning of the session. You know, that ignorance that says, oh, it's not really bad action, not really bad attitude, don't really have to abandon it, you know. So overcoming that kind of ignorance by seeing the danger in having that physical, verbal, or mental behavior. And then confronting it and averting it, you know, so doing something about it and doing it firmly, you know, not half-heartedly. Kind of like, well, I'm telling this little white lie, but, and I know it's bad and I should not do it. Yeah, so that's not really firmly confronting and averting it, is it? Yeah. So, you know, so I think the ability to firmly confront and avert it comes not from being hard and judgmental about ourselves, but it comes from understanding the danger. Okay? Because when we understand the danger, then our mind has wisdom, and we don't want to do something. And so then that gives us the courage to confront and avert it. But when we don't really understand the danger of this behavior, then there's no energy to confront and avert it, or the energy is really kind of wimpy. Hmm? So sometimes, you know, we have to really think about the disadvantages of doing something, and the disadvantages for others, how it harms other people, and also how it harms ourselves when we act in that way. And so some of our most cherished habits we have to question, you know. Is this something beneficial that I want to keep doing? Or is this something that I need to firmly confront and avert? Because yeah, sometimes our very well-cherished bad habits. You know those well-cherished bad habits? Yeah? The ones that, well, it's not so bad. It doesn't really harm others that much. I'm not that miserable when I do it, even though we are, you know. You know, beginning to challenge those by seeing the disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. Well, just, those little cards, the, you know, daily things by times, talks about, you know, I'm not going to be able to quote them exactly, but he talks about, you know, whether ethics are imposed from the outside, and when they're imposed from the outside, then they become problematic. But when our wisdom develops to the point where we actually see what is correct and what is incorrect, and it comes from inside of us, then that's the benefit. And I think there's a real chance somebody who is opposing on from the outside could end up just spinning their wheels, saying, is this okay, is this okay, is this okay? So really important part of this is you know, when wisdom acknowledges this, you know, is this harmful? And it comes from inside your heart, rather than feeling like God or mommy or somebody, you know, some unnamed being is up here saying, don't do that.
And that's the whole idea behind taking precepts, that we take precepts voluntarily because we want to keep them and we don't want to do these actions. And we realize that we need some strength, you know, to help us not do these actions that we don't really want to do. So it's not the Buddha said, thou shalt not do it. But it's we're realizing through our own wisdom and our own experience that we want to change this behavior. And that's a totally different way of keeping precepts and keeping guidelines. Yeah. Okay. So we'll sit quietly for a few minutes. But first, can I see who is taking refuge in precepts? Just to get an idea. 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay. Because I think it would be nice to have the refuge ceremony in here, and then the rest of you can meditate in the library. And then when we're done with the refuge ceremony, then we'll call you in and we'll do a dedication of merit for the whole retreat altogether. Okay? So for a few minutes, think about what we talked about. Let's dedicate. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the enlightened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their suffering. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore.